Welcome everyone to the Immigrants Journey Podcast. I am your host, Carmenetta, and today we have with us the lovely Isra Elsa Lahi. Is that correct?
Yes, it's Elsa Lahi.
Very nice, very exotic name. She was born and raised in Sweden and the child of Iraqi parents. And as a young girl, Isra was enchanted by the world of film and so pursued a career in acting. She put herself through a two-year acting conservatory at Lee Strasberg Theater and Film Institute in New York. Upon graduation, Isra began working on the famed Actor Studio. She has worked in theater, film, and television as well. Isra's TV work includes a lead role in the ABC series, What Would You Do?, Mysteries at the Museum on the Travel Channel, and ID on the Discovery Channel. This is in addition to her voiceover work on the award-winning animation series, Super Wings. Isra can currently be seen performing as Miriam in the Old Globes production of Noura, directed by Joanna McKinnon. Isra, welcome to the show. Delight to have you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on here.
So tell us, where were you born in Sweden and what was it like growing up there?
Okay, so I was born in Gothenburg in Sweden. So Gothenburg is kind of, there's three big cities in Sweden, Stockholm, Malmö, and Gothenburg. So Gothenburg is considered one of the larger cities in Sweden, but even so, it feels like a small town. You know, there's not too much to do there. And after you've spent a few years, you could easily get tired. And I spent 20 years of my life in Gothenburg. So it was a little tough. And I still go back every holiday, every winter, I go back to see my family because they're all still there. My sister moved to London. My sister is now actually studying in London. Oh, both my mom and my dad are both in Gothenburg. So I go and see them every year. And we usually take some kind of holiday, some kind of a family holiday if we have the time and money. Mm-hmm. So this summer, hopefully, we're going to go to Oslo, all of us. We've never been to Norway, funny enough, even though it's just like 3-hour bus ride away from Gothenburg.
Fascinating. So I was listening to another interview that you were doing with our mutual friend, Harry, Raphael Harry, and you mentioned in that interview that when you were raised in Gothenburg, that it was a segregated situation. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the Gothenburg, at least when I was growing up, and I think it kind of still holds true now, has sort of always been a very segregated city. So the way that, the clearest way to show it, I guess, is through even the way like the public transportation system works, where one end station of a tram will be a more or less all white kind of Swedish area, and then the other end stop on that train will be a fully sort of more like immigrant newly arrived area where you'll have a lot more diversity and people of color. So it's very different in that way. They're kind of kept separate from each other in a lot of ways, and things are changing a little bit more in the city now, but it's has been was a pretty big issue when I was a kid. And so I grew up working with a lot of youth groups in order to sort of combat that and have kids from different parts of the city come together and work on different issues that plague our society or different issues that plague us as young kids at that time. So when I was in high school, I was a part of this a group called a shared Future in Gothenburg, and we collaborated also with other like international groups like Spirit of Enniskillen, which is in Northern Ireland, and the kids there were dealing with issues between Protestants and Catholics. So in their groups, they would have half the group of kids be Catholics and the other half be Protestants, and so then they would come and bridge their gaps in terms of religious beliefs alongside us, where we would be dealing with other issues, but we'd come together as these kids are dealing with issues in our societies and trying to improve them for the better.
How effective do you think those programs were?
I think that they helped to a certain extent, but it is difficult because I always feel like, I mean, much like the issues we're having in America right now, there's a little bit of like, you know, the choir preaching to the choir, whatever the saying is, you know, you're kind of talking to your own bubble, and it's really hard to find. I think the main issue is trying to find a way of including people who are truly very different from each other.
Yes.
Putting them in the same room and trying to find some kind of common ground. That's where there will be hopefully success in it. I do think that the groups, the Spirit of Enniskillen group, were more successful in that,
mm-hmm.
because it's the differences or the political issues between the political and the religious issues between people of, I mean, I don't want to speak too much to their experience because that's their experience, but from what I could tell is it's so strongly embedded in their culture, the differences between or the animosity between Catholics and Protestants, at least it was back then, that it became, when you just had five kids that were Protestants and five kids that were Catholics and one in the same place, it did actually make a difference, you know? I remember doing workshops with them, and a lot of times they would break down crying and kind of were finding ways of combating that difference between them. And actually, it's really funny. It's been so long. I mean, I'm now 28. Oh my gosh, maybe I shouldn't say that. I don't know, a lot of podcasts. It's going to be out there in the ether. But I'm 28, and so this is 11, 10 years ago that I did this. And two of the people that were in the Northern Ireland group that were in SOE actually got married.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's like really funny to see like how just, you know, bringing those two people together from various different backgrounds, and then 11, 10 years later, they're still together and still hanging out. So for that group, it was really huge. And I still meet whenever I go back home, I do still meet up with the head leader of that organization. She was much older than us. She was kind of sort of like, I guess what you would call like a camp leader, but not really, because it's not a camp, but she had that sort of adult figure role.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I still see her from time to time, because it's just, that experience did help me a lot in terms of coming out of my shell as a person and being more social as well. Because I was bullied quite far up into, I was bullied up until I was probably about age 14, 15. And so it wasn't until I sort of came to, I came to like my later years in junior high and then high school, where I could sort of more open up and be the person who I am now, which is a very social, bubbly person. But I think as a younger child, I was sort of more kept to myself. And so it was really good to have that group to help me broaden my horizons and pull people together. And it did make us all meet people from all different kinds of neighborhoods, you know?
Right.
I would meet people from the other side of the city, and to me, their experiences are obviously different than the experiences that I had. And so, in a sense, it was helpful from that perspective. I don't know how much it did in the larger scale. I think it has to be more of a governmental push, which it's not being right now. Another difficulty in the situation or in the way things are is that if you're keeping people of a certain group or people who are like newly arrived to the country, et cetera, in the same area, you're making it that much harder for them to assimilate into society. You're making
Absolutely.
It harder for them to learn the language. You're making it harder for them to be able to thrive. I mean, my parents are incredibly tough and have found a way to survive in this kind of very harsh country. I mean, my mom had to, just my mom's journey is crazy. I don't know if I talked about this in Raphael's podcast, but when she came, my mom is a food chemist.
Yes.
I was a food chemist. She was an educated food chemist. She was top of her class and was meant to be sent to England to study for her second degree.
Yeah.
And through scholarship and all of it, because she was the top of her class. But then the war broke out and she ended up having to come with my father to Sweden. And then when she came to Sweden, they said to her that her education was invalid, even though the difficulty that it takes to achieve a degree in Iraq is far harder than it is to achieve a degree in Sweden. But they nevertheless said that it wasn't valid. And so she studied and took the classes she needed to. Basically, she took another degree just to make her food chemistry degree valid in Sweden.
Yes.
And then for 5 years, she tried to look for work in the field. Told her that she couldn't have work in it. I mean, how true is that? I don't know if it could have been because of her background. It could have been for all sorts of reasons. Back then, Sweden was even kind of more openly racist than it is now.
Mm.
And so she eventually, after 5 years, they told her that she could move quite far up north, where there was a lack of kind of all professions or not all professions, but of this particular profession and get a job there. But at that point, me and my sister were already 5'6". You know, my sister was a little bit younger than me, but we were in a place where she didn't want to uproot us, and so she decided to stay.
Yes.
And I went, okay, what job is in need right now? And obviously, as almost always, there's always a need for teachers.
Yeah.
And so she ended up going back to school, getting another degree, and now works as a teacher. So it's just kind of my parents have, they didn't let their conditions stop them. They still push forward. But, you know, I talk to my mom about this a lot, and it's kind of sad in the way where, like, I wonder where they would have been now if they hadn't come up with the issues that they had, you know? Like, my mom, I think, would have much further enjoyed being a food chemist. And my dad was a machine engineer, but when he came to Sweden, his spirit was kind of broken in a way. And he just couldn't, he couldn't get out of that. So he's worked many different various jobs, but I don't think he really ever worked. For a short period of time, he worked for Volvo, but it wasn't as a machine engineer. I think he was kind of on the factory line of it all.
What would you say has been, like, the most difficult obstacle that you've had to overcome in relation to, like, moving to America?
Mm-hmm. I mean, here's the thing. For me, I'm a very tough person, and America, it's been really difficult. I think just living in New York. New York is a tough city. For anyone who's not here, you'll know that New York is it's a really tough city, and it will make you... I mean, it's so easy to fall in love with it too. I mean, I love New York. I consider it my home at this point, but it's an incredibly tough city in terms of finances, and especially if you're an artist visa, because a lot of people don't know as well that if you're an artist visa, you're actually not allowed to legally work with any kind of job that isn't related to acting or is acting. So you're also starting from a point where you can't do anything and everything. I mean, most traditional actors will have, you know, a restaurant side job or will have some kind of side gig that helps them support their dream.
Yeah.
But for us, it's a lot more scarce. And so you find different ways of, like, you find acting gigs here and there, and that way you're able to provide for yourself. But anyhow, so it's a very unforgiving city in terms of finances. It's really difficult in that it's a lot of people. I come from a smaller town where there's a slower pace of life. That is not the case here.
Yeah.
Those kind of things are an adjustment. It still are always an adjustment. Every time I go back home and come back, you immediately feel the difference.
For sure.
And then you get engulfed in it and you kind of forget. There's like an amnesia. And then you go back home and you're like, oh, this is life. Like, life can just be easier and not a huge struggle. Wow. And then you come back and it's kind of crazy again. So that was one thing. But that has been probably the smallest issue in New York. Because for me, always financially or whatever, housing-wise, I've always found a way to take care of myself and pay my way. Like, there's whenever I think I'm gonna end up being homeless, I always end up booking a last minute gig and make up that money. And so, like, I one way or another, I always know that I will find a way to provide for myself.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of being, the hardest thing to adjust to has been sort of in the business, the way that it looks here.
Yeah,
I think a lot of actors come to America thinking that the industry is one way, and then you come and it's a full-on business. Yes, it requires talent and all that hard work and all sort of stuff, but it is a full-on business, and you have to learn a lot of things, and the business is constantly changing. So I think that's been the hardest thing to adjust to, and figuring out where to put your energy into as well, because there's so many different avenues you could go. There's so many different ways that you could go here as an actor. And I think kind of knowing what you want to do the most, or maybe focusing for a little minute on something, could be wise to do at times. But yeah, there's so many things to adjust to. There's adjusting to the tempo of life. There's adjusting to the sort of financial, that everything costs a little bit more here, and it's not necessarily, you know, any better than anywhere else in terms of living. So there's just some stuff that I've had to adjust to. But I will also say, like, to kind of be more on the positive side, I've also met some really close people. I made some really close friends here, people who I now consider, you know, part of my family in a way, that have been able to be here for me throughout a lot of tough times when my own family wasn't here. You know, because that's a difficult thing to not have your mom or your family here. I'm always kind of jealous of the people that have their parents like in New Jersey and then go back over the weekend and meet them and come back into the city. I wish I could do that as well, but I have made some really important bonds here, and I think that New York City is kind of one of those places where if you're having a bad day, someone on the subway might catch that and just be like, hey, why are you sad? What's going on? Like, that's happened to me before, you know?
That's before, really interesting.
Yeah. I think New York does get this reputation of being like
hard,
unfriendly city and harsh. And yes, I think the living conditions in New York City is harsh. And there is a lot of people who have to be kind of in their own space in order to survive. But at the same time, there is also a lot of caring people, and there is a lot of the community feeling. Like, just be in the subway when something breaks down and you have to wait for more than 15 minutes, you'll see like how all of a sudden everyone's kind of chiming in and be like, what is this, and like talking, making jokes with each other. Like, people come together through adversity in the city a lot of the time, or through minor obstacles and irritations. So I will say, no matter what, I do really appreciate that, and we don't really find that back home. I'm seeing people don't really say hi to each other in that sense, or they don't really. No, people don't really communicate with each other. People don't communicate with strangers at all, almost, I would say, back home. So it's much more of a colder kind of environment than New York. Mm-hmm. New York is dirtier and rougher than Sweden is. But it's, you know, in that roughness, there's also a lot of kindness. And so I try to keep that along, as well as a lot of craziness, too. I mean, a lot of stuff. I've seen a lot of things happen on a New York subway that I haven't seen anywhere else in the world.
I've heard. No, but I think that's like super important to be able to go to a new place and to make friends. It's definitely what has allowed me to get by and thrive in Ireland. Like, you can never underestimate the value of friendships. Now, do you feel that you've had to let go of certain aspects of your own culture in order to adapt to the United States?
You know what? Not really, actually. I think my family is Muslim.
Yes.
And I think moving to America, I do much more. I'm not as practicing now as maybe I was before I moved to America. I think it's become a little bit less practicing since I moved here. And I also find that part of it is kind of in a way that people are sort of, I always don't know how people are going to feel about my religion.
Right.
And I think it's quite common that I don't really talk about it. Mm. Because I don't, you know, if you end up, even some of the most liberal people will still like have a weird idea about Islam or not know enough about it, and therefore make some horrible assumptions. And so to avoid, you know, a conflict or whatnot, I sometimes just sort of keep that to myself. And then there are other times where I'm like, fuck it, I'm not going to keep it to myself because, you know, I'm proud and I want people to know and whatnot. And a lot of the characters that I played in my work are Muslim characters, and are not only Muslim but Iraqi characters, which I find really, really great, really is fulfilling to be able to represent my culture and represent my people. So in a way, I've also found that my bond to my culture has strengthened because I'm asked to play a lot of these characters who are Iraqi, who have different cultures, and all different Iraqi people. For Nora, I played Mariam, and Mariam is a Chaldean Christian Iraq, so she's actually a Christian.
Wow.
Iraq. Yeah, I mean, Iraq has all religions. This is the thing. Yeah. There's like Jewish Iraqis, there's Muslim Iraqis, there's Christian Iraqis. It's not just one.
Yes.
One thing. You know
it's like
mean?
Americans.
And it's like Americans, but I think we have like certain views of cultures that are painted by, you know, saying like George W. Bush. I don't think did Iraq any favors and kind of painted Iraq in a certain way and used Iraq in a way.
Oh, of course not. Yeah. I mean, if you have to convince your citizenry to be okay with the military going and bombing a certain location, you have to show that location in a very unfavorable light, or else people are like, what the hell are you doing?
Right. Absolutely. 100%. And so for me to be able to play characters that are bringing that to light and bringing, I mean, there's one character that I played from also Heather Raffle Place. So Nora was Heather Raffle Place. And then when I graduated, when I was doing my graduation conservatory showcase at Strasbourg, I did a monologue from Heather's other play, Nine Parts of Desire, which is a little bit more well-known, I think. And in that, it's nine different women from Iraq. And some of them are like Iraqi Americans. Some of them are kids, adults. There's all these women who have somehow have a connection to Iraq. And Heather Raffle herself is an Iraqi American playwright.
Yes.
So anyway, so one of the characters I play in that, and it's based on a true story, is this woman, Umgaga, who is living with 400 Iraqis in this bomb shelter. And they're all civilians. They're living in this bomb shelter during the war to protect themselves. And it's a civilian center. It hasn't been used for any military activity whatsoever. And this is quite well known.
Mm.
But then, during the early days when America is building smart bombs, George Bush had made, George W. Bush, I guess, had made, had basically attacked this civil shelter, this bomb shelter, with civilians in it, with smart bombs, because he wanted to test out smart bombs. But he used the excuse that there had been some kind of military activity, or they had signaled some military activity. There was none. There was no proof of it, none of that. They just needed somewhere to test their bombs, and they needed to test it on human beings in a bomb shelter. So they did. And so what ends up happening is that all of the women, all the people die, except Umgaga. She doesn't die because at the time she was not in the shelter. And so they all die, and then she stays on and makes the shelter into a museum because all of her children died. So for everyone that comes to the shelter, and there's people from all over the world that are coming to the shelter, she shows them around and tells them the story of what really happened, because she wants them to know the truth and not what was said in local, like, American
news outlets.
And so she stays on this horrible site where her entire family died a fiery, awful death. I mean, Jesus. They were trapped in the shelter as it was burning up. But she stays on and relives this pain every day in order to just spread some knowledge. And to me, those women are just so not just ever, you don't ever see. We're so desensitized to these human beings who are abroad from us, or different ways from us, who have full lives. They have children just like the rest of us. They have families just like the rest of us that they love. And these people were not involved in anything. They didn't take a part in this war. And then yet they still suffer the consequences. And so when I do get to play those parts, or when I do get to showcase those type of women, I try to. And it's a part of my cultural heritage. These women are a part of my culture. And so they are my background. I am Iraqi, and so I feel a huge connection to them, which makes it that much easier to play any character like that. I've never really struggled with playing those characters. If anything, I struggle with them being too close to me or too close to my family's history.
Yes.
And that becomes in itself kind of an obstacle. But in that way, it's brought me closer to my culture, because I'm faced with it more here than I maybe was faced with it back home.
Yeah. So tell me about a time in your life when your plans just went awry, did not go your way whatsoever. How did you recover from it?
I mean, it's really hard to think of one specific point. As an actor, I think we're always sort of dealing with disappointment and things kind of going awry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's smaller things, there's certain things, you know. One of the things was when I first decided I wanted to be an actor, because I was in med school for a little while, I did quite other things in the past. I wasn't always set on this path of becoming an artist.
Not to interrupt you, but I have to ask this because this is so interesting. So you were initially going to medical school. How did your parents feel when you're like, yeah, I'm not going to be a doctor, I'm going to be an actor? What was their response? Were they like freaked out?
No, they weren't freaked out. I think my parents are very supportive. I think they were worried because, just as any parent is, there isn't a lot of success stories for artists, right? Like, we see artists out in the real world, of course, celebrities and people are making money. but they're always kind of regarded as the one hit. They're regarded as people as these other beings who we are not related to in any way, and they're kind of unachievable. They don't seem like they're real in a way. Yeah. And so it's hard to, you don't hear a lot of stories about people becoming artists and making it. And although while like becoming a doctor or something in the medical field is far more secure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they were worried just in terms of like, how are you guys going to be able to support yourself in the long term? But once they saw that I was serious, because my sister is also an artist, she's a fine artist and filmmaker and kind of sculptor and painter, a little bit of all of it. So she's not an actor, but she's definitely an artist as well. And so they were worried for both of us in terms of like how we were going to survive financially and all sort of stuff. But once they saw that we were both serious and this is truly what we wanted to do with our lives, then they were supportive and try to help us in the best way they can. You know, my mom doesn't make a lot of money off a teacher's salary, but every month she gives my sister a certain amount of money to help her continue her studies and to help her with housing and whatnot. Like my mom sends at least like $500 to $1,000 every month to my sister, even though she barely makes, you know, enough money to help support her. So my family are very supportive in the ways that they can.
Yeah, you're very blessed to have that. But sorry, go back into sharing your story about when plans go awry and how you recover.
Right. Okay. So I think what it was just, you know, when I first then decided that I wanted to be an artist, I wanted to immediately start because I was at that point, I think it was like 20, 21
mm-hmm.
at that point. And then I knew, you know, like, oh, it's, you know, the younger you start, the better. Because you read all these stories about like 13-year-olds and 12-year-olds, like, or like, you know, people like Drew Barrymore starting out when they're like 10 or 7 or whatever, you know, that kind of stuff. And you're like, oh, I'm already way behind, you know, I got to get to it. And so I was like, well, how can I don't have any training. How can I get, how can I begin in this industry? What do I do? And so there was this program that my university in Gothenburg was doing with this university in Brighton, the University mm-hmm. of Sussex. They were doing sort of a cooperation where you could study, take English course classes in English literature
mm-hmm.
and at the University of Sussex, and it would be as if you were studying at Gothenburg University, so your tuition was covered. So all you had to pay for was sort of living expenses. And so I got this like little scholarship from my old high school and managed to muster up enough money to sort of be able to, and I was also working when I was in Brighton. I was working at Theatre of Brighton, which was this beautiful old theater, and I was working as their front of house there. And so I was working in England, going to school, and then the plan was to go into London and audition, you know, ever so often.
Yeah.
And obviously that was really naive because I had zero experience. I had no training. I mean, people who are trained in England barely get work unless they're trained by, you know, like RADA or Lambda or, you know, Center for Speech and Drama, Central Speech for Drama. You know, you have to have gone to one of the major schools in London in order to even sort of have a fighting chance to book work there. And so obviously it was very naive, and I decided, you know what, my dream has always been to go to New York. That was always the original plan, but then I chose this because I thought it would be a quicker way to get into the industry. And so I had to change my plans, and I had to come back home. I had to work for 2 years because I didn't have the money that I wasn't in a financial place in order to come and study here. So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to have to go back home and work for 2 years. And I did. I worked for 2 years and I did 4 jobs a week. I worked all kinds of jobs and was finally able to save up enough money to pay for my first year of tuition in full. And it was a 2-year program. So the rest of the year I could cover the rest of the education I could cover with my student loans. I took student loans as well, of course, to cover living costs and whatnot. But being able to pay that first year in full helped me achieve that dream. Because in Sweden, you can take student loans, but you can only take loans to a certain degree.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to take, you can't take as much as you like or as much as your education covers. They'll only cover what they will cover. And so the rest of it, you would have to muster up on my own. And so, yeah, that was one of those moments where I had a different plan entirely and then just was sort of quickly came to realize that wasn't going to work and had to sort of just turn anything around and try a different way. I feel like my entire life has been trying things in one way and then just sort of having to to go back and retreat and replan and go at it in a different way.
Yeah, it seems like you've chosen a life that's requiring you to constantly adapt. How do you feel about that?
You know, it's as fun as it is terrible at times. It's fun in the sense, you know, like I, even when it gets really difficult in this profession, I still think about it and I go, you know what? Like, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. Like, I wouldn't have wanted to be at a doctor's office or an office office. Like, any bad day here is still a better day, in my opinion, than a day at the office or a day at a hospital or whatnot. I mean, I do wish that I was in a profession where I could more directly help people. Mm. And I do believe that art and artists help people, of course, but and sometimes I'm like, well, are we doing enough for society? You know, is there a way that we could be more hands-on? And so I find opportunities and ways to volunteer around the U.S. And things like that. And I get involved politically here, even though I don't really have a voting right or anything. But, you know, I've gone to many rallies. I've tried to do my part. I think even with all of the difficulties and having to adapt all the time, that is also part of what makes it interesting, because the work is never done in that case, you know?
Exactly.
You're always having to learn new things and adapt in order to survive. And I think learning new things is great. That is something I really, truly have fun with and admire. So that for me is not a problem.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Because in a lot of ways, an artist's road in life is quite solitary, isn't it? Like, there's a lot of time spent on your own, by yourself, pursuing things before you actually become a part of an ensemble, a cast, a project. Right.
That's why I'm also very interested in ensemble work. Mm. I love ensemble work. I mean, one of the focuses that I've had in the past, kind of come to in the past year or so, has been working with, so I've worked a little bit with Labyrinth Theatre Company. I did a summer intensive that they had last summer. Well, basically, they had some of the Labyrinth Company consists of some really prominent playwrights and actors and directors from New York. You have Stephen Adley Gurgis, who's a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright and incredible playwright and was actor at one point. John Ortiz is the current artistic director. Philip Seymour Hoffman was the artistic director until he passed away, unfortunately. And so it's a really great theater group, a great theater company organization. And I worked with them during this intensive, partly. And the intensive is you're for a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. You're taught by all these different teachers how to create your own work. There's some classes in acting, but not really that much. It's more geared towards how to create your own work, how to get in tune with your body. And you're doing it with 36 other students. And you create a strong ensemble group from that. You're sharing your deepest, darkest secrets with these people because they exercise in the way that the meetings organized are in a way to get you to really open up. And it's completely free. I didn't pay a dime for it. The way I got in was my friend who had done it the year before nominated me. So you're nominated and then you audition and then based off of that you get in and you get this like incredible education over the summer.
Wow.
So I did that. And then from there on, I've ended up working. Me and a lot of my classmates from that summer have now ended up working with Labyrinth Theatre Company and other projects as actors and not just as a student. And what I really love about Labyrinth is this super strong ensemble feeling. Most of these people have been working with each other for over 20, 30 years. I mean, God knows how, you know, I can't say for how many, but I know them for these years. And something that really strikes me, and I find that if I would consider myself very lucky if I could be a part of a place like Labyrinth or have my own place like Labyrinth where I could just kind of work with a great group of artists and create those kind of family bonds and work with these guys for years to come. And people in the theater company don't solely work with each other. I mean, they go off and do films and they go off and do other productions and come back. But having that community, I think in theater is really beautiful and wonderful. And I hope for that to be part of my future career.
What do you know now that you wish you knew when you first moved to the U.S.?
Hmm. Well, there's a couple of things that I wish I would have known. And it's more pertaining to, I mean, there's a lot of things you just can't know. There's a lot of things you'll learn. I mean,
yes.
Just like housing in of itself is a huge thing in New York. I can't tell you how many crazy roommates I've had. Thankfully, I'm now in a place where like, I have good roommates and I like where I live and I like my area. But I've lived with, you know, same, all sorts of interesting people and the weirdest conditions. And I lived in an apartment, my first apartment in New York. I had three other roommates, so we were four people total. And everything just went awry. Like the doorknob broke off one day, so we had to like go through the fire escape. The house apartment got broken into. We had cockroaches. We had drug dealers living on the first floor who used to like count their money in the laundry room and like do their dealings there. And I mean, like all sorts of crazy stuff happened in that building. And I look back and I'm like, how did I survive my first year in New York? Like I lived in very sheltered up until like coming to this place and living with all this crazy stuff. But I think I'm just a person who's good at adapting.
Yes.
And dealt with it. But that, you know, like there's a lot of different things, like just like that, you know, like they have to, there are huge adjustments when you come. But I think for me personally, the biggest thing has been in terms of the industry, realizing that that you shouldn't take on what everybody, you shouldn't take on everything that people say in terms of acting. A lot of teachers, a lot of people will have a lot of opinions, but at the end of the day, it's what you think about your own process that's the most important. Take what you think is valid, take what you feel works for you, but by no means try to listen to everybody and everything, because it's just going to drive you crazy. And I did a lot of this, which is why I'm speaking from experiences. You know, I tried to like appease everybody and find a way of like taking on all of these lessons, and it's too much and just doesn't work, and it makes you kind of feel a little lost in your craft. But now I'm in a place where I'm not doing that as much, and I'm trusting myself, and I find that that is working for me much better. The second thing I will say is in terms of the industry, again, something my mom told me recently, which has been really important to me, is she always says to me, you know, so you got to be the right person at the right place at the right time. And I find that that holds really true, because you can work hard, you can do all these different things, but then you'll never know what it is at the end of the day that causes you not to book that part. Or it could be that your hair is the wrong color. It could be that the producer's friend, the producer owned an actor friend a favor, which has actually happened to me, you know? So there's like things like this that are not in your control. And so you just got to be the right person at the right time at the right place. Prepare, make sure that you're as prepared as you can for when those opportunities come. You know, do everything that you can in your power. But at the end of the day, you go in, you do your thing, and then you let go, because that's all you can do.
I think your mom is a very wise woman. And on that note, thank you so much, Isra, for being on the podcast today. And where can people find more of you? Are you on social media at all?
Yes, I am on social media. I have my webpage as well, where all my info should be updated, will be updated frequently. And you can also find press, my reel, all of that stuff there. So my webpage is my, are you going to have this in the notes? Or
I certainly that? Am. Yeah, I certainly am.
Okay, so great. So my Instagram is Isra, I-S-R-A dot Elsalhia, E-L-S-A-L-I-H-I-E. You can find it in the notes, I guess, as well. And then my webpage is the same. It's my first and last name.com. So IsraElSalihi.com.
That is beautiful. Isra, thank you so much for your time today. I hope you feel better soon. And
thank you.
Until the next journey, ciao.